Teddy, you've been in Louisville for several years now and have already made a tremendous impact on the orchestra in the city. Tell us a bit about the unique projects you've undertaken and how you see the orchestra's role in the city today.
Well, it's an amazing city, first of all. That's one of the reasons why I wanted to come here. I fell in love with the city right away. It's a real gem of a place that values artists and art and culture so deeply, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to be here. I think that you have to go where people appreciate and already care about the things that you care about, too. I think that I saw potential here that was really extraordinary. And one of the things that made it particularly interesting is that the orchestra here has a really special history with recording and creating new music, almost an unparalleled history. The Louisville Orchestra had a program from the 1950s that ran all the way through the end of the 80s that was pretty much unmatched in musical history. And it sounds like a very grandiose statement, but it's true. The city partnered with the orchestra to commission composers for those 3.5 decades or so. And these composers were really extraordinary, international reputation composers, people like Ludoslawski and Joan Tower and Elliot Carter. I mean, the list goes on and on. It was one after another. And not only did they commission them and premiere them here in Louisville, they created a record label called First Edition Records and recorded them, which eventually put out more than 100 albums. A really special story. And while that program ended in the early 90s, it gave a foundation for something that I think is so important to recognize, that a city like Louisville, which back in the 1950s would not have been a city people would have expected anything like that to happen in, could do something that really was not only groundbreaking, but really game-changing for the entire musical world, certainly the orchestral world, but even beyond that. The recordings that they produced inspired some of the most important living composers and conductors and musicians today. And so that history was a big part of why I was so attracted to the place. But I realized that whatever the fertile grounds were that gave root to that program were still here. And so I set about, when I got here, this is now my fourth season, finding every opportunity that I could to take that kind of energy, but maybe transition it to the 21st century into the era that we're living in now, and find ways of addressing the question of what an orchestra can be in our era, what it can mean to its community. I know every orchestra around the country, around the world really, but certainly around the country, is kind of facing that same issue and dealing with that same set of questions. And my answer was really to find the energy of the city, people's own kind of perspective on music and what they bring to the table, and connect with that. I know that's very broad in general, but that's been the guiding principle for everything that we've done.
The Louisville Orchestra went through some challenging times before you arrived, and you've worked hard to reestablish its prominence in the community. You just released All In, which I understand is the orchestra's first album in nearly 30 years, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah, the recording project sadly ended, and one of the challenges with the entire kind of orchestral community is that doing things that are very risky is actually not something that most large arts institutions are comfortable with. It's funny because most artists are very comfortable with doing things quite risky, and a lot of composers or individual creative people love to push limits and try things and experiment and see what works and what doesn't. But the institutions usually don't do that. They do the opposite. Usually they like to try and not rock the boat too much and not offend this group of patrons and not create a problem here and there. That doesn't lead to creative growth. And one of the things that we wanted to do here was, whether it was playing all kinds of styles of music, putting the orchestra in some really unusual venues, and putting myself in any random place that I could possibly find an opportunity to play music in, that we needed to take significant risks. And those risks, well, some of them we learned from. A lot of them have really paid off wonderfully, because people have seen the orchestra in a new way and feel really newly connected to it. And it's amazing. You can see how far audiences will go. I mean, one anecdote I often give is, we have a neighborhood series where we take the orchestra to different venues like churches, temples, community centers, all kinds of places throughout the entire metro region, really to connect with community wherever we find it. And we once did a program that was kind of, we were expecting perhaps our oldest, most traditional demographic, and we played a concert of all living female composers. And it was one of the most enthusiastically received programs that I've witnessed here. I mean, it was just like, and the music was, it was challenging. It wasn't just something that you could sit back and relax to. It was a challenging experience. And it was amazing to see how people that maybe you would have assumed would not necessarily love that program rose to that challenge beautifully. And we've seen that over and over again here. That's just one example of many.
We have quite a collection of American works on this album, from Aaron Copland to Cole Porter, and then your own composition, Unified Field. It sounds like this title relates to how the work ties everything together.
That's exactly right. It's really the idea of a unified field is a scientific concept. It's still something that people dream about. Scientists are hoping there is a unified field that binds together all the elements of physics and chemistry, you know, particle physics and cosmological physics. We haven't yet found that, of course. We don't have a single elegant equation, and you know, it may not be a single elegant equation, but there hopefully is something that connects everything all together. And I felt the same way about music, in a kind of tongue-in-cheek way, but also with some serious overtones, that despite the superficial sounding differences when you listen to Mozart versus bebop versus, West African drumming versus gamelan, you know, those that have superficial differences, and they're important differences, but underneath them is a universal language that makes all music work. And I thought in this piece I could explore that and reference as many musical styles as possible while still trying to make the work cohesive and at least honest and somewhat organic. And so that's why the piece is the way that it is. It has so many different musical references.
You're the soloist for the Copland Clarinet Concerto. Do you find this brings something unique to the orchestra? I mean, it seems most conductors that solo are pianists or violinists standing up there leading the orchestra.
Well, it's interesting because I had never done a clarinet concerto before without a conductor, and that's actually how we performed it. When we did the performances, they were done with no conductor, and in the recording session, we did have Jason Sieber, who was our kind of, he was the community engagement conductor here at the orchestra, a wonderfully talented person, to help because there's such limited time. We didn't have time to do, and also, since I don't practice, 8 hours a day anymore, my mouth, I was like practically bleeding by the end of these sessions. Literally. So it was not a pretty sight. I could only do so many high F sharps, so that's why we had Jason conducting. It's interesting because as a clarinetist, you naturally move and breathe in a way that pianists don't have to do, and even string players don't have to do. But on the other hand, a clarinet is a very clunky kind of baton. It's not a particularly elegant way to lead the orchestra. I realized by moving the whole clarinet around, people had no idea what I was doing. It was just so I had to find ways to like move my body that still gave people cues, but it could not be by swinging the clarinet around like some kind of weird band leader. And then that did not work. Especially the Copland Clarinet Concerto was one of the hardest orchestral concerti, just to play as an orchestra member. The string parts are devilishly difficult. I mean, they're famous for that. People quake in fear whenever they see that piece program. So I didn't want to mess them up by waving the clarinet in an obstructive way.
Well, the Copland is certainly an icon for the instrument. What made you choose to combine it here with these other works?
I mean, clarinet players, as you know, because you're one of the clarinet tribe here, we all know that we have pretty much the best repertoire outside of, maybe violins and pianists. I mean, we have such good, Mozart's best music, Brahms's best music. We just got the best stuff. And the Copland Clarinet Concerto is, I think, it's not just one of Copland's best pieces. It's one of the really emblematic American compositions of all time, because it's one of the perfectly synthesized pieces between Copland's own kind of modernist and also somewhat classical sensibilities. Like, it has a kind of classical romantic soul to it, but it's also modern, and it's also unmistakably American. And it's so honest. Like, there's no point in it when you go, oh, he's being silly or that's cheesy. It's never cheesy. When it's jazzy, but in Copland's own voice. And I can think of very few compositions that achieve that on such a perfect level.
You're joined by vocalist Storm Large on this recording, and you've included an original song by her. Tell me about your collaboration and how she sort of completes the puzzle here, doesn't she?
Yeah, she does. And Storm is Storm is a very special musician and a very special person. If you haven't seen Storm Large, I would Google her, perhaps in a, you know, not at work, but anyway, but you can Google Storm and get a good sense for her. She is really just one of the most talented entertainers and personalities and deeply naturally talented musicians that I've ever worked with. And she represents, I think, a real kind of American possibility here. Somebody who, even though she doesn't read music, doesn't have formal classical training, learned Kurt Weill's Seven Deadly Sins herself by listening to some of the early recordings of it, and performs it as fluently and as captivatingly as I've ever seen. Somebody like that, I mean, that's such an that's an American thing to just, you know, see something and go for it and be able to do it incredibly well. She came to Louisville my first season. People loved her. They loved her immediately. And I think she, in her own way, in her own life, is paralleling some of the things that we're trying to do, maybe on the flip side, with connecting all kinds of different styles and elements. She's doing that herself, and I thought, what a great emblematic person for this first album.
Teddy Abrams, music director of the Louisville Orchestra, here on 88.9 WCVE Richmond Public Radio.